referring to the DARPA file. That was Project Diffuse, that was uncovered by Project Veritas. R.C. Maxwell here, filling in for James O'Keefe, who had to step out. We have a couple of hands up. Mr. Tom Fitton, go ahead.
Yeah, to follow up on Dr. Malone's point, you know, my concern is that this is the tip of the iceberg. A, we can presume the federal agencies working with Pfizer and Moderna were aware of this type of experimentation. We need to know the details of it beyond what we're hearing. Who knew what and when? They work hand in glove with the FDA on this. I guarantee you there's funding and collaboration with NIAID, NIH generally, and HHS. And then secondly, we should presume if Pfizer thinks they can do this, its competitors are doing it, and independent laboratories separately looking at this are doing this type of experimentation, because, you know, this is government operations in effect. And they like having these types of experiments and activities going on in more than one lab if they can do it. And so these are dangerous times, and I think there's urgency for public officials to figure out what's going on and stop it before another contagion decimates us.
And I just want to say I strongly concur with what Tom just said. This suggests the casualness of the statements. Suggests that what we're looking at is a widespread normalized practice within this entire industrial sector. Over.
This really reminds me of, in terms of the level of medical ethics and the necessity for a public debate given the stakes. The last time we had this in this country, I think, was around stem cells and around cloning, and that was some years ago. And given the tailwind of government spending that's now attached to everything around COVID, the idea that they could be playing a game of hiding behind prophylactic development. You know, this is somebody at the very beginning suggested that, what are we going to hear them say as their excuse if they have to, if they're forced to, based on the public outrage, address this head on? They're going to say, we were doing what science does. We were testing the boundaries for the common good. But when the stakes are so high, doesn't the common good have to weigh in as well on if we think they're acceptable and that the risks that they're taking combined with the obvious profit motive that exists? And I think that this could really catalyze that debate, much like we had the debate around stem cells and cloning in the last 25 years.
Yeah, I mean, I would submit, to follow up quickly, that no legislature at the national or state level would ever agree to gain-of-function research. This is a creation of the Fauci sector of the medical research community. They convinced themselves that they deserve government funding. The government, you know, Fauci partnered with them. Others partnered with them. But, you know, Congress hasn't approved this, and nor would they ever. And so it should be just presumptively deemed inappropriate, and anyone doing it should be investigated, given the radical, you know, the dangers of it, you know, the future dangers of what would happen, in addition to investigating whether or not it caused the current pandemic.
Yeah, and the ethical defense here and the attempt at reframing that we'll probably see over the next couple of weeks is going to take the form of describing dual use. In the biodefense sector, this has always been the argument put forward for justifying gain-of-function research. It's sort of like an arms race where we know that the argument goes something like this. We know that China is going to be doing this. We know that other potentially dangerous actors are going to be doing this. So we have to do it too, in order to keep up and in order to try to develop potential defenses against these types of pathogens. I think we're going, and I'll explain in just a second why that argument doesn't really hold weight and how to respond to it, but I think we're going to see the same thing here. Pfizer and their defenders in the corporate media and elsewhere are going to say, no, look, what they were really trying to do is develop more effective vaccines for a future variant. They weren't trying to create a super virus to harm people. They were trying to create better vaccines and anticipate where COVID is going to go in the future. And so I think we need to be prepared for that kind of counter argument in an attempt to justify this. And I think in the biodefense realm, the idea of nuclear proliferation is often held up as an analogy. You know, the Soviets and the North Koreans are developing nuclear weapons. So while we would like to get rid of all of our own nuclear weapons and not engage in developing weapons of mass destruction, we have to do it for the defense of our nation, because if they have it, the only deterrent is that we have it. And if they have it, we need to figure out how to defend ourselves against it. And you're going to see a similar argument when it comes to gain-of-function research. The difference, of course, is that a nuclear weapon does not accidentally walk out of a nuclear silo on someone's shoe and accidentally detonate quite easily. In other words, it's once you create these viruses, it is virtually impossible to contain them. Even if the BSL-4, the high security laboratories, followed all of the strictest guidelines that they're supposed to follow, which they don't, and there's very little oversight, but even assuming that they did, one slight human or systems error is enough to release these highly dangerous pathogens into the population. It's as though you were working in a nuclear silo, and you know, on any given day, if you didn't do 12 things in the exact right sequence, the nuclear bomb would be launched. You know, the nuclear missile would be launched. So gain-of-function research is actually a kind of death cult. And the "we have to do it because they're doing it" defense only proliferates the danger. It does not provide any sense of security. It only increases the odds, the plausibility that one of these viruses is going to get out. And so, I think it's important for people to be equipped with, first of all, an anticipation of what the defense is going to be, the moral justification or the scientific attempts at justification, and also understand that those analogies don't really apply, and that it clearly Pfizer was creating potentially creating a super virus. Whether that was their intention or not doesn't really matter. The fact that they were doing it, and the fact that that dangerous virus wouldn't exist in the world without the experiments that they were engaged in, I think that's the decisive point.
Can I amplify a little nuance on what Aaron just said? The press repeatedly assumes that the Wuhan Institute of Virology funding comes just from NIAID. I broke the story last fall. The Defense Threat Reduction Agency within DOD, in the Threat Mitigation Group, which is exactly the same group that's responsible for, let's say, mitigating the threat of nuclear proliferation, is also the group that is capitalizing the Wuhan Institute of Virology from the United States. Well, what Aaron has just shared actually is profound and deep. It may seem a superficial analogy, but structurally, it is the same folks, it's the same culture, it's the same institutions that are handling both the non-proliferation, quote-unquote, agenda, as well as this type of dual-purpose research, as he's describing. Over.
I want to make one more point, that just a riff on what was said earlier about the some of the political issues and the structural issues here in the United States. It's very clear that the Department of Justice is defending Pfizer. And I think someone mentioned earlier the FOIA request to get the Pfizer clinical trials data. I was the doctor that coordinated that group of doctors and scientists to file that FOIA request to Pfizer to get information that under federal law, Pfizer was required to release the day that Comirnaty was given provisional authorization. So the legal issue in that FOIA request is very, very clear. We were simply asking the federal government to do what it was required to do under federal law. There was no debate about that. But the Department of Justice lawyers representing the FDA in that case, as many of you probably heard, tried to slow walk the data. They said, we'll give you 500 pages a month, which if you do the math would have taken 75 years to release data that the FDA reviewed in only 108 days. Then Pfizer intervened, and Pfizer said, let us redact that data before it's released to the public, and which wasn't surprising, given that that may have been in their corporate and their financial interest to redact data that may have undermined safety or efficacy of the vaccines. But what was surprising to us was that the Department of Justice lawyers representing the FDA agreed with Pfizer and petitioned the court to allow Pfizer to redact the data. So when it came time for the FDA and the DOJ to do their job in terms of transparency and actually just following what was very clearly laid out in federal law, they instead sided with this corporate interest and sided with trying to protect that corporate interest. And that's just, you know, one small piece of evidence. I'm sure Project Veritas and others that have been doing work in this area could cite other pieces of evidence of this melding of state and corporate power, this trend that we've seen particularly during the last 3 years, but building up probably over the last two decades, of a kind of corporatism where the state is not acting in the interests of either the rule of law or the elected representatives and their interests, but acting in the interests of particular corporations that they have basically gotten into bed with. And where the state and the corporate interests, for one reason or another, are aligning. And we're seeing not only the power of a multinational corporation like Pfizer being able to protect itself, but the power of the United States government acting on their behalf to also protect them. So this is going to be an uphill battle.
This is Jane.